Hello, welcome to the Higher Education Researcher. This episode is slightly different. It is not a conversation with a member of the research community. Instead, it is a recording of the first out of four webinars in the series to celebrate 25 years of the doctoral program in educational research higher education, or as we call it, DEEPER. This is one of the two programs that are associated with the Center for Higher Education Research and Evaluation at Lancaster University. Enjoy the recording. We're just going to start. First, thank you for attending this panel, which is a kickoff event in the series throughout September to celebrate 25 years of the doctoral program in educational research, higher education, or as we call it, DEEPER here at Lancaster. So I want to start by saying a huge congratulations to all students, alumni, and staff, current and past, for this DEEPER birthday, which is a remarkable achievement. And everyone who has contributed to DEEPER in any way is actually now part of the DEEPER family. So congratulations to each and everyone, and thank you so much. In fact, many of our audience today is indeed a member of the DEEPER community, and thank you so much for attending. We especially appreciate that you are here with us in this alternate form due to the global pandemic. Otherwise, we would be meeting face-to-face in Lancaster and cheering, but this is the best we can do at the moment, so thanks for coming. I want to thank our distinguished speakers today. This first panel will set the scene for the webinar series. There will be three other webinars following today. But today's panel will focus on higher education research as a field. We must take a step back now and again and reflect on our own field. And we will discuss how the higher education research as a field has been developing throughout the past decades. What are the crucial findings from higher education research today? And also, what is the role of different university departments, research institutions, and even doctoral programs in establishing higher education as a field? So our speakers today are all active higher education researchers and well-renowned, probably not even needing an introduction. Our first speaker is Dr. Jelena Brankovic. Jelena, if you can wave so people can immediately identify you. She's based at Bielefeld University in Germany. Jelena is a coordinator of the Early Career Higher Education Researchers Network. I'm sure she will talk about this. And also a member of the Board of Governors for CHAIR. This is the European network called Consortium of Higher Education Researchers. Welcome, Jelena. Our second speaker is Professor Paul Ashwin. He is head of the Educational Research Department here at Lancaster University. He is a past staff member on the DEEPER program. He is the coordinating editor of Higher Education, a co-editor of the Bloomsbury Book Series, Understanding Student Experiences of Higher Education. And he's also in the management committee of the Center for Global Higher Education. Welcome, Paul. Our third speaker is Professor Malcolm Tait, who is the current DEEPER program staff member, past director of DEEPER of many years, I think 14, and researcher of the higher education field as such. Malcolm is the editor of the book series International Perspectives on Higher Education Research, the editorial advisory board member of the Journal of Education and Work, and also past editor of Studies in Higher Education. Welcome, Malcolm. And as for myself, my name is Janja Kominovic. I'm the current DEEPER program director. I'm also co-director of the Center for Higher Education Research and Evaluation at Lancaster, with which DEEPER is associated. And it is my absolute privilege to work in these two roles. So today I will be mostly taking the role of the chair of this panel, but I will also come in with some contributions of my own during the debate. Just before we start the discussion, I would like to say a few words about DEEPER, since this is a celebratory webinar series. And DEEPER is one of the first doctoral programs in the field of higher education research. Since its beginning, it has been designed for those who are already employed in the sector, but very broadly conceived. It is residentially based, with students coming to Lancaster four times per year and staying every time for a week. And it's organized in two parts. So in part one, in the first 2 years, program is structured and the
three core modules allow the so-called publish as you go model, where many of our students in fact publish their research before finishing their PhDs. And in part two, that is the third and fourth year, students focus on their PhD research and thesis. So affected by the COVID pandemic, we have made an important change for our next cohort starting in January 2021, which is that we are moving the program entirely online for them. Our hope is that we will return to the residentially based model for the cohort starting in January 2022, but this obviously depends on how the pandemic develops. We are indeed very fortunate that the Educational Research Department has a decade of experience with online PhDs, so this is not something unthinkable for us. And also all the staff on the program is experienced in these other online PhD programs. For more information, please see our web pages. And now before we start the debate, just a few pointers for our audience. You can post any questions or comments in the chat area at any time. Myself and Rebecca Morrison, who is helping out today, will be monitoring the chat area at all times. So if appropriate, I will read out the questions during the debate or at the end, depending how it will go. Also, this panel is being recorded, so it's being recorded at this minute already, and we will publish it on our YouTube channel after this event, so it will be publicly accessible. Okay, so let's now start with this debate. My first question will actually go to Paul, since this is a kickoff panel for the celebratory series of the webinars. It might be good to start with you, Paul, placing the DEEPER program in the Educational Research Department. So just who is Educational Research Department and how does DEEPER fit into it?
Thanks, Janja. So first of all, it's great to be here to celebrate 25 years of the doctoral program, and also to have so many current students, alumni, people who are teaching and have taught before on the program here, and it's lovely to see you all. In terms of the department, as a department, we're very focused on researching education. Uniquely for a UK education department, we've never offered professional teacher training. We've always been focused on education as a research activity. Indeed, when the department was set up 52 years ago, we were originally set up to research the university, to research teaching and learning practices in the university. And our first lectureship was a lectureship in university examinations. So in a way, that's focus on higher education research and thinking about higher education practices has always been a key focus of the department. And the program, the DEEPER program, really reflects a number of those kinds of commitments. We're very focused on working with our students, in a way interacting with them as co-researchers. They bring their expertise of their different higher education contexts. We bring our expertise on researching higher education, and we come together to research. And in a way, that's reflected by the fact that we have a number of alumni from the programme who now teach on the programme. And it's great that we have those synergies. It's great that we have that continuation over time. So, you know, that kind of gives you a sense of the programme and where it fits in relation to the department.
Okay, thank you very much, Paul. Just to remind our participants, please feel free to comment or chat at any time in the chat area. So now if we move to the discussion on higher education as a research field, I'd like to ask Jelena, what is higher education a research field today from the perspective of early career scholars and from your perspective? How do the early career scholars perceive it? And also, if you can tell us about the ECHR network that you are coordinating. Yeah. Yelena, the speaker, I think.
Good. Okay. So first, congratulations on the 25th anniversary, and thank you for organizing this panel. I'm truly honored to share this virtual space with all of you today and talk about higher education research. And especially given that I'm not the most experienced of the panelists when it comes to this topic, so it's a challenge. But I would like to start with telling about ICHR, and then I'm going to try to connect that with how we see the field of higher education research. And I would say there are at least two approaches to this. The first one would be more, you know, conventional way of seeing it. And ICHR, which stands for Early Career Higher Education Researchers, is an international peer network of junior early career scholars, mostly doctoral students, postdocs in the area of higher education studies. You may have come across our blog, which is maybe the main project that we have, and which is where we collect and share resources, information on things such as conferences, journals, publishing, writing, and the contributions to this blog are chiefly made by junior scholars. So it's a kind of early career people for early career people. Now, currently, when it comes to the network itself, there are something like 230 people in it, who are based in almost 50 different countries, mostly in Europe, but not Europe alone. And in fact, this is one thing about ICHR, is that we try to keep it as open and as inclusive as possible, in an effort to, you know, create a community which is truly worldwide. So as you may imagine, it's a very diverse network. Our research profiles, interests, backgrounds, work environments are immensely varied, which speaks volumes of our field. And now for those of you who have been in higher education studies for a longer period, you know, and especially if you have looked at it more systematically in the way that, you know, Paul has here and Malcolm especially has done, it may be clear to you what this field is. You know, what are the questions we ask? Where do we publish? Who is who? And so on. However, if you're new to higher education research, the field itself is not so obvious. So then the questions such as, what is higher education research? How is it different from educational research? From science studies? What does it mean to be higher education researchers? Who am I? Is higher education research only in higher education journals or not? And so on. These kind of questions become important. And they're especially important if you're not institutionally embedded in higher education research group, or if higher education research is not so big as an area of study in your country or at your department, such as it is the case in, for example, Britain or Germany or US or some other places, where we have not just long established research groups or doctoral programs, but also national societies, specialized journals for those countries, different opportunities to network, conferences, funding, and so on. So higher education is more recognized. And many people in ICHR are, of course, you know, in those countries, you know, like UK and Germany and so on, but a great many, and maybe even majority, are people who are not part of this institutional kind of setup. And it is for these people where ICHR actually comes as a very important instance to kind of reach out and to have a sense of a belonging. And in this sense, and this is maybe the second approach to how we can see ICHR, and that is that ICHR is an experiment in a way. So given the diversity, not only of the topics, disciplines, methods, and so on, and we know that in our field, we have many of those, but also in terms of the needs people have, you know, different opportunities that we have to collaborate, to explore the field. The idea behind ICHR is to give a sense, or maybe strengthen the sense of higher education scholarship as a worldwide undertaking, in a way, you know, global community, even so to speak, one which then comes with shared spaces in which we can get in touch, reach out, support each other, and look across the fields in the divisions. And, you know, why not do maybe more or better as a community and as a field? So that would be maybe in a nutshell about what you're trying to do.
That's great. Thank you. Thank you, Yelena. So if Paul or Malcolm would like to reflect or comment at any time, just indicate, please. I can see you both. But that's a great start, Yelena. I think this diversity of, you know, themes, richer themes, interests, disciplinary approaches, methods, and so on, it is quite confusing for someone who is interested in you know, higher education as a field and so on. And I can also reflect on my own experience of entering this quite some time ago, but then also just how hard it is to actually grasp what it is. So I'll just go to Malcolm now, who is obviously a researcher of the field as such. What do you think, Malcolm, is higher education research field in terms of foci? So what themes does it include? Which research methods are used? And also, I'm quite curious, what do you think of how did it change in time? So especially in the past decade or so, you know, what are your thoughts on this?
If I was to sum it up in a word, I think I'd probably say it's a mess. It's very amorphous as a field. There are lots of people in it, but most of them are focused on it part-time or short-term, and most people in the field don't look much beyond their own particular topic or methodological interest. So while overall there's thousands of people at any one time researching higher education, most of them are completely unaware of what 95% of the other ones are doing. And this is the case even if they're doing something which could be very relevant to your own personal topic. You know, they're just taking a somewhat different methodological or theoretical approach. But, you know, I might add that this is common in research in all subjects. Where higher education research differs is it doesn't have the kind of strong disciplinary overburden that an established discipline or subdiscipline would have. So people who enter higher education research come from very different backgrounds. They don't generally have an induction into it. You know, most people are not formally trained in higher education research. So of course the DPIR program is one aspect of something, trying to do something about that. So it goes on much like that. How it's changing, that's difficult. I think it's, there are fashions, there are trends you can detect. You know, the last 10 years or so, people have got very interested in student cheating, for example, and you can also see a growth of research in providing accommodation with for people with disabilities. You know, these research foci seem to generate, and maybe they will decline in the future. But it's a very interesting field. It's a field in which you can have a great deal of fun. And I will stop there.
Okay, thank you, Malcolm. I see, Paul, you have been nodding enthusiastically all the time. Would you like to comment?
Agreement's never particularly useful for these kinds of discussions, but I would completely agree with Malcolm that sense of it being a field of inquiry rather than having a kind of disciplinary focus really characterizes a lot of what goes on in the field. And there's also, I think, a sense of, you know, often people are very keen to research the field before they read about the field. You know, and what Malcolm's work has been incredibly important in doing is really charting the research across the field of higher education and giving it a structure that enables people to be far more informed about the kind of research that goes on. You know, the number of times as you work through the field, you might go to a conference and you find someone very excited about something completely new they're doing that you can relate to lots of other research in higher education, kind of shows the problems with some of that situation. But, you know, as Malcolm says, it also makes it a very exciting field in which to work. I think the other issue that kind of relates to a challenge about it is that, you know, all people working in higher education know what higher education is. To them, it's obvious. And if you're working in that field and you don't fit with their obvious view of what higher education is, then clearly that doesn't look like high quality research. You know, clearly there's something wrong if you're challenging their well-established experiences of what that higher education field is like. And that makes it, you know, really challenging to find ways of helping people to understand how that your research might challenge the ways in which they think.
Great, thank you, Paul. So there's a question from the audience from Malcolm, but I will also then ask Jelena to answer the same question. And it tackles the field in its diversity. So the question is, around the people coming into the field, how we might train them as to the key areas of the literature. So how would you actually devise a canon, given that the field is so diverse and amorphous? You know, how would you tackle that? Malcolm? Yep. Sorry, Malcolm, I think I accidentally muted you, so if you could unmute yourself. Thank you.
That's difficult, because there was a chap in New Zealand whose name escapes me at the moment, described higher education research as an open access discipline. I mean, as Paul said, everybody who works in higher education or studies in higher education or has some contact with it has their own view on it. And often that's a very committed view, which they're reluctant to modify or give up in any way. So how you could enforce not allowing such people to contribute to higher education research, I don't know. How you could require them to undertake some kind of mandatory training before they express themselves, I don't know. It would be very difficult to do that, and probably not the sort of thing we want to do. But there are the standard sorts of controls we have for people who want to contribute to conferences or journals, where they have to go through review processes, which work to a fairly reasonable degree to try and keep up standards. I'm not sure there's much more we can do than that. And, you know, welcome, tolerate and criticize the variety of views that come forward. Other than that, I could say they should all be forced to buy all my books, but that would just be self-serving.
Thanks, Malcolm. Jelena, do you have any thoughts on that?
Yes. It's a very interesting question. And indeed, the question of canon comes. I come, for example, I did a master in higher education about a decade ago. So we were kind of indoctrinated in a certain canon and what are the main works and so on. And of course, that's your starting point. And I'm not sure whether, you know, thinking in terms of canon is very productive in general, but I think that maybe should maybe more try to, you know, think about different bridges between different disciplinary languages, different kind of questions and different methodologies that we can identify and we can work within. Because as it has been already said, it's a fantastically you know, diverse, rich field. There's so many different angles and interests, and we need to search for ways to capitalize on this without trying to kind of establish some sort of a or enforce some kind of a mandatory reading or mandatory boundaries of it, but to keep it open, and at the same time also taking care of the legacies, right? And this is something that I think Paul said in the beginning. I know that people don't read much, you know, about what else is being done, and we need to also try to look more in that direction. So maybe that would be my take on the canon question, but it's a difficult question, and it's really difficult, as Malcolm said.
Thank you, Jelena. So my next question is to Paul. What do you think are the particular challenges of studying higher education? There seems to be a problem with the microphone. I'm not sure if Paul is, I can see you moving, Paul, but I'm not sure. Okay. No. Let me see. What's the problem?
Thank you. Every time I click on mute, I get a message telling me that the host is mute to me. I'm just saying that in a defensive way so that it's not my lack of skills that of engaging these kind of debates that's causing me problems in this particular occasion. So challenges. I think we've covered some of the major ones in that previous discussion. I think other related challenges of researching higher education is that, you know, clearly as with most social science research, it's an open system. You know, there's lots of different factors that come into play, and so it's really difficult to get a sense of how things are being formed and what's forming what. And then also, as kind of related to things that we've talked about, is you've got lots of conflicting interests about what higher education is trying to achieve, what it should be doing in society, and that kind of creates tensions in lots of research and raises questions about the extent to which research is there to prove a particular point or whether it's there to actually explore and find things out. And I think for students coming to study higher education, that can make things feel very difficult. Also, you know, the kind of range of theoretical perspectives that people take in higher education in many ways is a real strength. But when you first come to look at higher education, that can be incredibly confusing. Often, I think for PhD students, there's this kind of search to give a name to what you're doing. If you can label yourself as a particular kind of researcher, then it's all easy. All of my problems are solved. And whilst it's understandable why that's attractive, often that can lead students, PhD students, to struggle because actually having a name doesn't really do anything apart from give you a name. And also, if you take a name and then do something different, then you look like you don't know what you're talking about. So that kind of openness of the field makes it difficult to get a grip on. And I do think, you know, that previous discussion about canon, I don't think it's about having a conservative canon that places constraints on people. But it is a challenge of a discipline that's largely performed through journal articles rather than through synthesizing texts that bring together structured bodies of knowledge. That sense of what are the structured bodies of international knowledge we have about higher education I think is a really important challenge to address. And I think, you know, in the work that Jelena's doing, in the work that Malcolm's doing, there's contributions to that. In the work that I've done with other people on reflective teaching in higher education, what we've tried to do there is to bring together the international literature on teaching and learning in higher education to say, look, here's a structure, so that it's not about the individual research project that people tend to really focus on, but it's about how that relates to an overall knowledge structure that, of course, constrains in some ways, but has far more power than any individual research project.
Great. Thank you, Paul. I think this quite nicely relates to a question we have from the audience for all speakers. What do you feel about the relations between higher education research and the other fields and disciplines it intersects with? So Brett thinks that earlier we have briefly mentioned that some higher education researchers are employed in departments in unrelated disciplines, such as STEM, but you know, it's also others. What do we feel about how such people can contribute and what doing so might do to their careers? And what kind of relationships do we feel higher education has with educational research more generally? It's a minority interest there, or is it taken seriously? So basically, what's the role of researchers based in other disciplines and their contribution to higher education and the relationship between or placement of higher education in broader education research field? Malcolm, would you like to go first?
Well, I'd make a couple of points there. One is that higher education researchers talk very little to educational researchers, and they don't tend to read each other's stuff, which is probably a category error, because there isn't something that happens at age 18 that makes the issues and the questions fundamentally different when you enter higher education. The other thing I would say about the disciplines is that in most cases in practice, if you're based in a discipline, sociology, philosophy, physics, whatever, it disadvantages you in career terms if you focus too much on higher education research. But looked at in a different way, there are disciplines which are far more advanced in higher education research. If you look at medicine or healthcare, there are a huge amount of higher education research has been done in those disciplines and published. You know, journals like Academic Medicine produce far more articles each year than what we might see as the leading higher education journals, things like Studies in Higher Education or Higher Education. Academic Medicine's been around a whole lot longer and has much greater output. But again, there's little interconnection or interchange there, which is a pity.
Thanks, Malcolm. I'd just like to add that networks such as ERA, which is the European Network of Educational Researchers, who organize these huge conferences, ESER, once a year, is quite useful in the sense of bringing together everyone from really broad field of the educational research, and higher education is one tiny strand there. So that's quite a useful way of trying to sort of make links between different levels and also topics and themes. So before I give the floor to Jelena, just to read the next question, because it connects as well. So Jurgos is asking if higher education research is focused on governance and research to the detriment of teaching and learning, in your opinions. And I'm sure that other people might reverse the question as well, because higher education research is really so broad. So it includes, and Malcolm has this really nice categorization in his work where he shows the levels from macro to meso to micro, as well as really the broad array of themes and topics and interests spanning, you know, all the way from governance, leadership, to the, you know, even identities of students and stuff. He also added, he adds that he is a STEM person in physics, researching higher education, and he feels it indeed has not helped his career, just to add. So Jelena, would you like to tackle Brett's question more broadly?
Yes, I think that's, it's my living question. Institutionally, myself, I'm kind of an in-between. So I'm not a part of a higher education research group. I'm at Faculty of Sociology, I'm Sociological Theory Group. I used to be part of a higher education research group, but I'm not now. And my group now is, among other things, looking at, you know, the history and institutionalization of rankings across sectors. Academia being one of them. So, you know, we are like 6-7 people and we look at how rankings operate in different settings. So I'm one of the, maybe the only person in that group who identifies as a higher education researcher and has this background. So what I'm trying to do is I'm trying to look both ways. So I look on the one hand as how I, as higher education researcher, and how higher education field can benefit from the work that my colleagues and I are doing related to other sectors, related to the more general sociology. But I also look at how I can bring or export the knowledge produced, you know, the insights from higher education studies into broader sociological work. So it's a kind of a challenging position, and I also came to learn that I'm not alone in this. There's many of us who are in this in-betweens, you know, that we have an opportunity to span these boundaries, to really work in a community or in an environment which allows us to do both. My colleagues understand this and they know this, and I can relate to this, notion that yes, you do higher education studies, that is a little bit less valuable than what we are doing. But that also depends on how you approach it. Yeah, so it also depends how you approach it. So I try to publish in both higher education outlets and more general outlets, and I try to have a conversation with different kinds of audiences and to establish myself as a kind of boundary spanner, right? I mean, this is maybe, you know, in quotation marks. And then, you know, rankings, they are kind of as a, you know, convenient simply because they're, you know, they're everywhere and they go way back, but they're not everywhere the same. So I really try to see, you know, how is it that we can broaden our perspective on rankings in academic setting, you know, by having, you know, a good understanding of what they are in a more general sense. So this would be my two cents on this relationship between the discipline and the field.
Thanks, Jelena. Paul, I'll also give the floor to you, but if I can squeeze one more question in, because I think you're really a good person to answer this. A question from Pete, saying that there seems to be far less debate about developing evidence-based or research-informed practice in higher education in comparison to school education. So what do you think is the impact on policy and practice of research into higher education because of this fact?
There are plenty of people who do work on evidence-based practice in higher education. Clearly in relation to teaching and learning, it gets tied into different kinds of debates around academic freedom and the importance of academics having a role in deciding what and how they teach, and that being an important element of an academic identity. And to me, I think one of the issues that relates to that for higher education research, and it relates back to one of Malcolm's earlier comments about the lack of crossover between education research and higher education research, is that, you know, even research on teaching and learning kind of very much focuses on teaching and learning rather than a broader understanding of higher educational as something that's educational. You know, what does it mean to be educated within higher education? And I think, you know, you can look at the lack of research on curriculum in higher education. The lack, you know, again, Malcolm, in his reviews of higher education has shown that, you know, people don't tend to use the word curriculum. It's far more foregrounded in teaching and learning. And that for me kind of, you know, reflects this kind of tendency in some higher education research to take things as they appear rather than thinking about, well, actually, what is teaching and learning about? Teaching and learning is about offering an education. And how do we understand the educational process? You know, the impact of policy and practice of research in higher education, it probably has as much and as little impact as educational research and perhaps social science research more generally. You know, it has some useful things. People establish long-term relationships with policymakers or practitioners and have an effect, and an awful lot of it's ignored. But that's, again, the nature of kind of social science research. And it's a kind of, you know, I always think about that as a double-edged thing. You know, the only thing worse than being ignored by policymakers is being listened to by them and them taking your idea, implementing it, and that, you know, acting in a negative way on everyone's life. You know, it's a kind of, you know, the idea that straightforwardly impacting on policy is always positive. I think we need to be a bit more cautious than that and maybe think about how we offer ways of thinking rather than offering oven-ready practices, to use a phrase that our Prime Minister is very fond of, the UK Prime Minister, I should say.
Thanks, Paul. So now if we move to the findings from higher education research and reflect a little bit on that, I'm wondering, Malcolm, if you can tell us, what does higher education research show, or the findings coming out of higher education research, on the main challenges for universities today? So what would be, in other words, a research-informed way of looking at what are universities facing today?
I think the main challenges facing universities today are pretty much what they always have been, i.e. survival. And you can look at that in a existential way, or you can look at it in a financial way. But the same issues are there as were there 200, 400 years ago. And the current climate is kind of irrelevant from that point of view. You're just responding to particular challenges. In COVID is the current one, but in 5-10 years' time, it will be something else.
Yes, I guess ultimately it is about the survival of universities, also the nature of universities and the role of higher education more broadly, isn't it? So Jelena, could you maybe share what you think are the main trends in higher education today deriving from your research? You already mentioned you're looking at rankings and global competition. I know you're also interested in quantification more generally. So what do you think, how these trends are affecting higher education today?
Rankings. I mean, we all know they are highly controversial, right? Everyone has opinions about rankings, and, you know, we tend to not like them very much, coming from, you know, as academics, but, you know, also especially as scholars of higher education, this comes as no surprise. Yes, there are some general trends, and we definitely have more rankings today. The number of initiatives globally which produce various imaginaries of, you know, what the world is like, what we should see as worth in it, and which draw on logics of comparability, ordinalization, hierarchies, prestige, performance, and so on, the number is growing. And also, as volumes of higher education research has shown, is that their effects are pervasive, more pervasive than ever, right? We do have rankings, you know, for going back more than 100 years in the case of academia, but never have they been so consequential as they are today. And there are a number of reasons why this is the case. However, we tend to see, and this, I mean academics, and also mean researchers of higher education, we tend to see rankings as an alien, kind of exogenous force, you know, something that has been imposed or has been part of the broader package of, you know, neoliberal market, you know, driven dynamics. And what we tend to overlook there is the fact that some of these logics, especially, you know, hierarchies, performance, prestige, they're not quite alien to academia. And they were not brought into academia by rankings. Yeah, so they kind of run deep in how many of us, you know, see ourselves and how we see each other in academia, you know, individuals, you know, especially universities, critical stakeholders in higher education, students, many scholars, you know, tend to believe somewhere. We can see this when you look at the kind of research we are doing, when we look at the language that we use, we tend to believe in a sort of a natural status of hierarchies of academic performance. And we must not lose from sight that we speak here of a kind of a worldwide game, right? So one could argue that there is a kind of an almost natural affinity between what the rankings do and the academic enterprise. And this is for, you know, one of the reasons why, you know, rankings are in academia kind of a success story, right? I don't want to now overly stress this, but, you know, so we tend to overlook, you know, this, you know, we tend to focus on how rankings affect us, how they, you know, pervert or how they corrupt us and so on. But we forget to ask why this is the case. What is it about academia that makes this the way it is? You know, how are we part of it? How, you know, and this is maybe, you know, something that I'm kind of not avoiding us to answer your questions in general about trends, more about the kind of a trend in higher education research that we tend to overlook this important part of the puzzle of, you know, why are rankings on one hand controversial, they lack legitimacy, but on the other hand, they have an effect and many people take them seriously and so on. So maybe, yeah, this would be something that comes from my angle.
Yeah, thanks, Yelena. So not only about rankings per se and their existence, but actually the other way of ways of looking at them and understanding them also, and placing them more endogenous to the field as well. Thank you. So, Paul, you've mentioned before already the notion of educatedness, if I made the notes correctly. So I'm now curious about your research and in relation to the field of higher education research. And you talk about the notion of graduateness. So can you tell us more about it? And also, how does it relate to the roles of universities in our societies today?
So thanks for that. So, you know, I'm very interested in the way in which higher education gives students access to bodies of knowledge that transform them and transform their sense of who they are. And for me, this is the role that higher education more generally plays in society. It looks after knowledge for society. It offers a way of bringing knowledge together into bodies of knowledge, as I've discussed before, and makes them available to students. Plays that crucial role in, you know, almost offering a way of curating these bodies of knowledge. And I think that focus on transformation, for me, highlights the extent to which a lot of higher education research and a lot of policy, and indeed rankings, as Yelena's talked about, kind of get very trapped by seeing higher education as the sum of individual institutions. You know, individual universities are incredibly noisy entities, and people tend to really focus when they talk about higher education, they're talking about universities. And this is at the cost of a focus on systems of higher education. And for me, what this does is it really promotes a view of higher education as elitist and reproductive. It's about being in the best institution with the best students and the most resources, rather than focusing on the system as a whole and say, how can we have a system of higher education that's inclusive and transformative? And I think that, you know, the discussion around rankings kind of helps to highlight that. But it also, you know, Yelena raised the question about why have they, you know, become so visible now? And a large part of that is money. You know, commercial rankings exist to make money. You know, that's why, you know, different people are very interested in putting them together, it means that they can offer consultancy to universities to improve their position in the rankings. They can hold expensive conferences and invite people to talk about their rankings. They can cut the data in lots of different ways and have lots of different rankings, a South American ranking, a new university's ranking. You know, this is not about measurement. This is about increasing income. And focusing on universities and becoming obsessed with individual universities as higher education just plays in. Whereas if we stand back and we say, okay, within the UK higher education system, how does everyone benefit from that system? Within the European system as a whole, and so on. And actually thinking about what these systems give us rather than focusing very much on individual universities and what they do.
Yes, Paul, could you just continue? We have a question from Bernard who is asking, how can the transformation agenda that you now talked about best challenge the current hegemony of, you know, value for money and this kind of instrumental view of higher education?
Yes, so I mean, it's funny, the kind of value for money in the UK context, and it's important to point out, is that what are described by UK politicians as low value courses are courses in which graduate salaries afterwards are lower than you would expect, which means that the return on your investment in their terms isn't what you'd expect. But you know, what's been so interesting about COVID-19 is that suddenly the graduate salaries of people graduating last summer will suddenly be much, much lower than previous cohorts. Is this because the quality of university education has suddenly dipped? No, it's because about the state of the economy. And the idea that the quality of your degree determines how much you earn is such a nonsensical position that I don't think the transformation agenda needs to undermine that. Simply, as the economy changes and this, you know, this has been introduced in the UK as a relatively new way of thinking because of the data that's been available. But as people look at that long term, the nonsense that that's related to quality rather than being related to the state of the economy, the social class of students, the geographical location, those are the things we know determine salary, not the quality of your education. So I think in a way that, I'm not sure it is a hegemony, or hegemony, whichever way you say it, tomato, tomato. I would say that it's actually just a kind of short-term thing that is likely to ebb and flow because actually the data doesn't support the position.
Thanks, Paul. So you're focused on higher education as a system, you know, instead of just some of all the institutions. I think it's quite a nice transition to our final section, talking about higher education research as a field and higher education as a system more broadly. So the question for Yelena is, how would you describe actually the role of research centers and PhD programs in establishing higher education research as a field? Especially, you know, at the beginning, we kicked off our debate by discussing, I quite liked the phrase that Malcolm said, that higher education doesn't have disciplinary burdens like some other fields do. So, you know, what is then the role of these actual then institutions? And since we haven't mentioned this yet, where are these centers and programs based? I mean, I know you can't really, you know, list them all just now, but if you could just point our participants to sources or where they can find information about this. But just, you know, in a sense of what is the role of research centers and PhD programs in establishing higher education research as a field and understanding higher education as a system, if you will, as well.
Yes, higher education centers, I think they are crucial. And anyone who has ever had a chance to work or spend some time with a research group of higher education scholars and being interested in higher education knows how important this is, you know, for various reasons. However, in reality, this to me now, I don't have numbers on this. I can tell about the people in each network, you know, where they are located and so on. And if we look at institutional affiliations of each members, what I see is that about one third of people, so it's about 70-80 people, are in 15 institutions, right? And there are about, I think, 140, 150 different institutions in the entire network. So there is concentration in these, 15, let's say. The largest countries where people come from are the UK, Germany, there's Russia, and there are some other countries after that. And half of the members are affiliated with universities in UK, Germany, US, Russia, and Finland. Yeah. And then we can go there. There is Austria, and there are some other places in Europe. So you can really see how important it is for a country to have this kind of institutionalized research environments, societies, journals, funding, professorships, career paths, and so on. So research centers are part of this larger infrastructure of opportunities that people can have if they want to have career in higher education research. For the most of the people who, cross the path of higher education research, and as Malcolm said, the part-timers and those who are still, especially junior scholar, we're still exploring, right? Maybe we stay, maybe we don't stay, maybe we just cannot afford to stay in higher education research for various reasons. For many of us, it's actually really, really difficult to have career paths outside such an established systems, such as the one that you have there. So it is important, of course, to have this for the field, for the development, and especially career opportunities for people.
Thanks, Jelena. So my next question is to Paul. Since DEEPER is one of the oldest PhD programs in the field of higher education, why was it established? And if you could tell us about how you see the 25 years of this program, how has it changed in time?
I think in terms of why it was established, I think, that sense of offering people who work in higher education who don't have a doctorate a path to getting a PhD through research in higher education, that's been key to the way the program's operated. And if we think about the 25 years of the program and the people who've studied and taught it, so when it was initially set up with Peter Goodyear and Rosemary Deem and Peter Knight as key people in the department and on the program, and also key scholars in higher education research. And then with myself and Paul Trowell and Maurice Saunders and Malcolm, there was a kind of phase where we worked. And now within the department with Yanya and people like, Jan MacArthur and Anne-Marie Houghton, it's also become more diverse and more international in its outlook. And I think, that sense of always having a key position in the higher education field, but increasing in our range of focus and increasing in the diversity of what we do is what's so exciting about the program and what's so exciting going forward. And then looking at the things that our graduates and our current students achieve through their publications, through the work they've done, how many people who've studied the program have then gone on to become key figures in the field is just incredibly exciting. It's incredibly exciting to be part of such a dynamic higher education community, and I'm sure that will continue for a very long time.
Thank you, Paul. So my last question goes to Malcolm. You were the DEEPER program director for many years, that's between 2005 and 19, if I'm not mistaken. How do you see the role of this program in the field of higher education research? And also, I wonder, what do you wish for DEEPER in the future?
What you were saying, what do I wish for the program in the future? Well, I wish continued success. One of the things that struck me from analysing higher education in this country is that it's still the case that less than half of academics have a PhD or its equivalent. Most of the people who teach in our university are not qualified to doctoral level. And this program and similar ones, part-time, mid-career, have a lot to offer in trying to upgrade people so they can enhance the way they go about teaching and learning, but also better develop their own careers within higher education. That's an important role. Was there another question that I'd forgotten?
So basically just how you see the role or the position of the DEEPER program in general in the field of higher education research and the contribution of DEEPER.
I think, like Paul says, it has made a vast contribution, and we perhaps have not been as strong as we might have been in publicising and presenting that more widely. And as he said, there are many DEEPER graduates who occupy or have occupied very significant positions, and they've also published collectively a huge amount of articles and books, some of which are on our website, made a major contribution, we would say, to developing the field. For instance, you could probably say that the interest in phenomenography has been very largely stimulated by the doctoral program.
Great, thank you. So we will conclude at this stage, wishing DEEPER all the best in the future, as Malcolm says. Just before I let everyone go, just to remind everyone that there are 3 more webinars coming, each consecutive Wednesday. So next week, on 9th of September, there will be a webinar with the current students and staff talking about their experience today on the DEEPER program. Then on 16th of September, there will be alumni talking about the impact on their careers and personal lives. And then finally, there will be a webinar showcasing examples of DEEPER research. So there will be a student, an alum, and a member of staff. So thank you very, very much, Jelena, Paul, and Malcolm. You've been fantastic. I really appreciate you attending. Thank you to all our participants, members of the DEEPER family, and everyone else for coming and attending. And all the best for everyone in the future. Thank you.